Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We made this.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tony Black.
And I'm Carl Sweeney.
And welcome to The Discourse. The Discourse takes a weekly glance at the world of cinema and entertainment, chewing over news, box office, and everything in between. Before we start, quick reminder, please follow us on Twitter at PodTheDiscourse. Drop us an email at contactthediscourse@gmail.com if you like what you hear. And if you do have time, subscribe and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Help bump us up the podcast charts because we're a new podcast and we want to get going. So, Carl, welcome to The Discourse.
Thanks, Tony. It's really good to be doing this. It's a bit of an impromptu podcast, isn't it? This has come together fairly quickly off the back of a discussion we had in person just about a week ago. Not even a week ago, actually. So, yeah. Good to be getting it underway, really.
We don't rest on our laurels, do we? You know, it's quite good. We've podcasted many times before. For those of you listening first time, we have been podcasting together for, I'd say, a good 5 years now. Firstly, on the X-Cast and X-Files podcast, which is the community we met through. And a brace of others since. We had a podcast called Motion Pictures that we both did together about 2 or 3 years ago, where we did about 20-odd episodes looking at film. And you've got your own film podcast called The Movie Palace as well, which is all about classic cinema. And we're part of the We Made This podcast network, which is a broader podcast network with lots and lots of film, TV, content, loads of stuff. So we've been at this for a while, haven't we, Cole?
Yeah, I think like most male podcasters, we podcast together. That's our way of socializing, isn't it? That's the main reason. Really, that's the reason. We've never explicitly said that to one another. Like you say, we've been doing it for a while. We've done several different shows, and we always sort of circle back to one another, it seems like, don't we? So
we do.
I've been very pleased to guest on your podcast, Partisan, recently, for example. Mm. And then, and we are good mates. We meet up in person to normally to see a film or to do something like that. We're always chatting about this kind of stuff, so why not record it? Why not formalize it, isn't it? That's the argument. Why not do it this way?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because we met through podcasting and through a fan community online. It then bloomed into a lovely bromance in person, and now we just enjoy recording together. And we do it, like you say, we do it fairly regularly on each of the shows and various other projects. But yeah, we do talk a lot about this stuff. We do send each other things on Twitter and various other things. And you know what? It's like, yeah, let's just shoot the breeze and talk about this stuff. So the general idea of The Discourse is that we're going to talk about things that are... We're not going to review films as such, but we're going to talk about things that are in the discourse out there on social media and in film magazines and various other things that are kind of going on. And maybe our own experiences, which we're going to start off with today, as well of things we've done and we're going to and we're involved with, talking points that we've come across that we want to get into. So I think it'll be quite broad, quite varied, hopefully. We'll just see where it goes, I think. A loose but deceptively controlled format, Carl, I would say.
Yeah, accessible, hopefully, for people. I think that was the idea, because I think it was I suggested it to you and I sort of said, because we've never done anything like this. All the things we've recorded about before, it's always we'd take one big idea, or we take one film, or we take one episode of something, and we sort of spin things out from that. But I think what we've never done is bounce around a bit from topic to topic and sort of go through a few things that are out there being talked about. So that's sort of the idea, isn't it? So we'll have to get used to it, Tony, because we're used to just taking a topic and going on for an hour and a half. This is going to be different, isn't it? This is going to be a bit more, like you say, we're going to jump around a bit. But we'll see how it goes. I think it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah, I think it will. We do that in person, don't we? When we get together, like we just race through different stuff. Have you seen this? What's going on there? Have you done that? You know, yeah, it's great. So yeah, we're just going to bring it to podcast form. And, you know, if you, in case you're wondering, who are these guys? Why should I listen to these guys? We both have some experience in this kind of field, not making movies necessarily, but you're a film lecturer, so you do a lot of things in the Midlands in the UK. You're teaching at universities and things like this about cinema, and you've published as well in various publications and books about film, about specific films and theory and research as well. And I've written a few books. Carl's highbrow, I'm lowbrow, just to let you know, guys. he's the film theorist with all the with all the great film theory. I'm the guy who writes like books about Star Trek and Sean Connery, which is coming out very soon.
I'm not sure about that, because you've done the Joseph Campbell thing, haven't you, about various TV shows.
Okay.
So I think there's a bit of overlap. Yeah, yeah. That's it, basically. So I teach currently at University of Wolverhampton. I've taught at the University of Worcester in the past. I work at the Midlands Arts Centre. We're going to talk about that venue, aren't we, very shortly.
Mm, we are.
Like I say, I got a few things published as I'm currently working on a PhD, which has taken up a lot of my time over the last few years, coming towards the end, hopefully. And yeah, like you say, you've been cracking out the books like nobody's business, and you got like more in the pipeline. So it's fun. This is the kind of stuff we enjoy it, don't we? And we obsess about it. And then lucky enough also to be able to write about it, podcast about it, all that sort of stuff. So yeah, this is the stuff we love. That's the main point.
Exactly, and hopefully that's going to come across in the conversation. So, before we do get cracking, if you want to follow what we're doing a little bit more, you can check us out. Primarily, I'd say you and I hang out on Twitter, really. So I'm at AJ Black Writer on Twitter. So if you want to come and follow everything else we're doing and talking about, that's the best place to find me. What about you, Cole?
Yeah, Twitter is the main place where I push out all the links to the podcast I'm on and that sort of thing. So I'd say at CKJ Sweeney on Twitter is the main place people can find me, and I'm much more active on there than I am on things like Instagram. I know you are too. So Twitter is our main destination, isn't it?
Yeah, my wife keeps sending me things on Instagram to look at. And then she tells me, did you watch that thing I sent you 3 days ago? I'm like, no, because I never go on it. You should know by now. We are Twitter boys for now anyway. And now Elon Musk doesn't seem to be buying it. You know, that might last a bit longer, but we'll see.
if anyone wants to see pictures of me running, that's basically the only thing I use Instagram for. I haven't been running this week, so I've been a bit inactive. So.
What are you running from is the question, you know? Is it a way of existentially, you know, purging some pain, Carl? Or is it, you know, do you just like running?
It was a bit of a lockdown thing, actually, because I'd never been a big... I hadn't run since school. I never enjoyed stuff like cross-country running. And then I think it was lockdown three. Okay, let's try Couch to 5K. Give it a go. Do a couple of weeks. And I actually managed to get to the end of it and keep it up. So, yeah, Instagram's helpful for that because... you know, you kind of think, well, I got to post something. I haven't posted for a while. I got to go for a run. So that's it, basically. I don't do much film stuff on Instagram, though. That's the main point.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. As a sidebar, Lockdown 3, one of the better third entries in a trilogy. Anyway. But yeah, let's get into it then. Let's get into some discourse. So we met up on last Sunday as we record, and we contributed as an audience to a season that's going on at the BFI, a season of celebrating Pam Grier, the classic 1970s onwards blaxploitation star. And specifically, we went to watch Tarantino's Jackie Brown from 1997 at the Midland Arts Centre, which is a place very dear to both of our hearts. And we actually saw Pam Grier herself on stage as part of this several cinema tours she's doing. She's doing a couple in London. She's done one in, as we say, Birmingham, sort of introducing the film, but we'll get into that. it was good fun, wasn't it, this?
Yeah, really good fun. Like I said before, I do work at this venue, so, you know, potential conflict of interest there when I say how great it is. I'll just flag it up. It was really good on a few levels. It was great to see her in person, like you said. That really, I mean, I would have wanted to go and see the film anyway, because I really like Jackie Brown, and I haven't seen it on the big screen. I hadn't before this weekend. So that would have been good anyway. But having her there to do an intro was fantastic. And she stuck around later for, there was a screening of Coffee and a Q&A, but we couldn't stay for that. But anyway, Jackie Brown was brilliant. Secondly, really good to see something like this in Birmingham, isn't it? Because quite often what would happen is, let's say someone like her was in London, and like you say, there's the BFI screenings in her name, in her honor, you wouldn't always get someone like her going up to Birmingham and doing something like this too. So that's fantastic. And I think the region needs to see more of that because it's a great city, Birmingham. The Midlands is a great place. And I know you're feeling that because you're this is your hometown, but you don't live here anymore. And I think you're sort of feeling that nostalgic pang from afar.
I'm an expat now. Yeah, I'm an expat. And it's while I live in the West Country now, and it is beautiful and, you know, much nicer in many, many ways. It is always a little that you do get that little pang. I miss things like the Mac because down here I've got one Odeon within within driving distance that isn't ridiculous. And I have to make do with that to watch cinema. Whereas in Birmingham, there's all these wonderful venues. So, you know, apart from the traditional sort of nostalgic aspects. Yeah, I miss being able to zip over to the Mac and places like this to go and see stuff because they are doing it. And you're right, it is great to see this translate. And I think that's a credit to the work of David, who is the film programmer at the Mac, I know a little bit, and he's great, and he's really, really beats the drum to try and get these things into the Midlands. Because, like you say, Birmingham's like it's officially the second city of the UK. It's just had the Commonwealth Games, so it's been in the media massively, a lot the world over, in the last few months, and it's about time, really. I mean, this has been a debate, and it's a bigger debate we could get into another time. But there's long been conversation about. Why is London the only place that gets the film premieres, that gets the critic screenings, that gets the events like this? And slowly that is starting to change a little bit. And now you're seeing more things in Birmingham, in Manchester, you know, but there's still a long way to go, I think, really. So it was great to see it here.
Yeah. And it's one of those things I think as an outsider where I live very close to Birmingham now, but I'm from elsewhere originally, but I think locals around here have this kind of very self-deprecating attitude. And don't often realise just how great a place it is. Do you know what I mean? So you always hear a lot of people saying, there's the stereotype, isn't there, that Brummies sound miserable and all this. And I think, self-deprecating is what I would say. So, yeah, we need to recognise this great place. And, yeah, this was great to have her here. And it made it very special. And there's a lot of interest, wasn't there? Tons of people there to see her.
Yeah.
To see both films. So that was fantastic. And just a brilliant film, Jackie Brown, in my opinion. It's always been... it's long been my favourite Tarantino film, and it had been the only one I hadn't seen at the cinema. Because I think the basic story is that, obviously, Pulp Fiction had been a huge hit from the sort of independent film sector. I just recently read a book called Hollywood Ending by Ken Auletta, which is about Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, yeah.
So obviously that goes into how Pulp Fiction was a huge story for the Miramax studio, right? Jackie Brown then comes along a few years later and is, I think it did respectably, but commercially it wasn't anywhere near the force that Pulp Fiction was, Jackie Brown. Mm. So it always had that reputation of being a bit of a second string in Tarantino's bow compared to Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, I think. So when I used to say to people it was my favourite, I think you would always get people pushing back and saying, you're just sort of saying that because... you know, you think everybody loves Pulp Fiction, you want to be different. But I think over the years, I think people have grown fonder of this film. And I think it really is seen now as one of his best. I think it is. So how did you find it all?
I loved it. I mean, it was... I felt very, very much the same. It was my favourite Tarantino for years until Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came along. And that's unseated it as my favourite because, I mean, we both love that film. We talked about it on Motion Pictures if you want to go and seek out the episode.
Yep.
And, you know, we're big fans of that one, his most recent movie. But it's hard to, even watching it on the big screen, it's hard to disagree with the possibility that this is his best movie. I do think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is up there anyway as one of his best movies. But this, it just has a really, it has a real maturity to it that really belies... his journey in cinema, if you like, at this stage. You know, this is his third movie, and or maybe his third 3.5 movie. he might term it differently, you know, because he counts things like four rooms or something stupid like that. Who knows? But this is a great piece of work because he manages to bring in a lot of the things he loves. And a lot of the movies and the particular genre he's riffing on here, without it being too in your face, you know. And I think it. I mean, and much as the Kill Bill movies are fun, they are very in your face. And I think, you know, I don't know if they've aged quite as well, but I think this really has. You know, this has really matured. It feels like a proper grown up, skillful echo of the blaxploitation movie mixed in with the crime thriller. But then he's adapting a source material. You know, he's adapting Rum Punch by Elmore Leonard. And I think that must go a long way as to why it grounds him, you know, as a filmmaker. But it's fantastic.
Yeah, but I think he definitely makes it his own thing, because, I mean, the most obvious example is the book, Rum Punch. The main character is called Jackie Burke, and she's white. So he's obviously, that is the race swap thing, which is kind of, this long before the whole discourse about race swapping characters, really. It's something he did back in 1997. Yeah, no, it's a fantastically relaxed, confident film. I think the way I've always thought about it is, and this is me taking a cue from what Tarantino himself had said, but I remember when he used to give interviews about this film, he would compare it to the Western Rio Bravo from the 50s, the Howard Hawks film, which is John Wayne, Ricky Nelson and Dean Martin. And what he was basically saying is, well, that's a Western that, yeah, it has a plot, but it's very relaxed with it. And you sort of, it's more about hanging out with the characters and spending time with these people. And Jackie Brown's like that, I think. Because obviously it has some of the, it has the Tarantino elements, like explosions of violence, but much in a bit of a different way to something like the Kill Bill movies or Django or something. It does have a plot, but it takes its time, and you really do just grow to really, whether you love these characters, you're really interested and curious about these characters. And I think that's one of the things that strikes me about it every time, is there are always little bits of business you forget. Like I said to you going in, that I really love Robert De Niro's performance in this film.
Yeah, so funny, as Lewis Gara.
And you forget about some of the little details. Like there's a moment when he's on the phone and he's trying to like disentangle the cord, and it's all that stuff really played really well on the big screen.
It was really funny. People were laughing in the aisles, weren't they? The jokes landed so well. Well, not the jokes, but the comedy of some of these characters and some of the thing. It really landed, didn't it, with the audience?
Definitely, and that was one of the great things about seeing it in this way.
Mm.
But I think you're right. I think it's like with some of Tarantino's films, I do like this more than the Kill Bill films. I like it more than something like Death Proof. With some of those others, it's like, if you're not as interested in the genres he is or the types of filmmaking he is, maybe that can be a bit of a barrier. But with Jackie Brown, it's obviously playing around with the history of the blaxploitation film. Obviously, the casting of Pam Grier is the main factor in that, and some other things. The soundtrack, for example. But if you've never seen any of those films, I think you still, I don't think that's going to put you off. I think there's tons to admire here. Do you know what I mean? Whereas I think with some of those others, I think you might sort of miss out if you aren't as versed in like martial arts films as he is, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not massively conversant in blaxploitation movies. You know, I have seen Coffee, I've seen Foxy Brown, so I've seen a couple of the Pam Grier ones, but and the original Shaft ages ago. But I think you can really enjoy this as its own, as its own piece of work. So I think you're absolutely right. We've got a Discord on We Made This for podcasters and listeners and things like this. And I asked about what people thought of Jackie Brown, and there's a few comments. Perry says Jackie Brown is easily Tarantino's most underestimated film, which a few people agreed with. Ian said, doesn't nearly get the attention that it should. I think it was my first. It's one of my favourites. Mike says, Jackie Brown is one of the best films of all time. Just saying. You don't have to agree. You can just be wrong. And then Ian comes back with, my hot take is that Reservoir Dogs is as overrated as Jackie Brown is underrated. What do you make of that, Carl?
So I don't know if we can still call Jackie Brown underrated when you're getting all these messages saying how brilliant it is. That's the tricky thing. It's like, how do you measure that? Because it's just it's having this national re-release now as well, and I think I saw 5 stars in the Guardian for it. So even back in the day, there were some really laudatory reviews for it. So I don't know; it's really hard to say. I do like it more than Reservoir Dogs, but I like Reservoir Dogs as well. I think it's just he was at a very different place then, because that really was kind of a shoestring budget film, wasn't it? That he happened to get some good actors for, and you know, I think this is very different. This is obviously his third film, and he's a big celebrity after Pulp Fiction, especially Tarantino. So, yeah, I'm not sure I'd fully subscribe to that, but I think this is a marvelous film. And but before we move on, Tony, I think you need to talk about Pam Grier's appearance in person, which you mentioned earlier. How did you find that?
I loved it. I loved it. I mean, I alluded to the fact she didn't really talk about Jackie Brown, and I don't think she did at all. I don't think she even mentioned Jackie Brown technically, or she might have done very fleetingly. But it was great. I mean, it was one of those. She was really charismatic. She was really funny. It was one of those 10-minute introductions where you really didn't know where it was going half the time, in a good way. But there were points where we were just looking at each other, going, "Oh wow, she's veered to that topic. She's going to that topic." But she was still full of beans. She was really enthusiastic. You know, I think she was just really pleased to be there and to have this celebration, which is called Foxy, Fierce and Fearless. And, you know, it was great. What did you think of it?
Yeah, it was great. Like you say, it was very warm and unpredictable, like you said. I think some news out there I wasn't familiar with. I don't know if you were, but she seemed to be talking about a Disney series. It sounded like a Disney Plus series to me about her life.
Foxy.
Right, which I hadn't heard about before. That sounds potentially very interesting. I think that could be a great subject for a series, really, because she is a trailblazer. You know, and that whole 1970s milieu especially is going to be fascinating to put up on screen. So that was news to me. And she talked a little bit about the people they've got to play. It sounds like there might be a couple of different people playing her, doesn't it? At different ages, perhaps. So, yeah, I'm not sure if that's been announced. I hadn't heard about it before. Had you?
No, I hadn't. No, and she did a piece in The Guardian where she talked a bit more about this and how she said that they've got to find a couple of different actors to play her at different ages. So they've got to find a child one, they've got to find an adult one. And I don't think they're quite there with that yet. I think they're in the middle of the casting. And she said they've got to find the person with that magic to do it. But I can totally see this. You know, we've had on Disney Plus things like Pam and Tommy, you know, that have explored a particular, you know, thing in with people playing real life people. There's lots of these examples now that are happening. And they can be really good. These limited series, you know, almost biopic TV shows that would have been movies back in the day, that would have been something like, you know, Ray with Jamie Foxx. You know, they're now making them into like 6 to 8 part series. So I think it could be really good. I think it could really put you in the environment of the 70s, making all these films, all these actors, directors, you know, seen behind the scenes, making things like Foxy Brown and Shaft and all this kind of, and you know, I think it could be really, really good. Definitely. But I'll tell you the most amazing fact that came out of that piece. She lived in Swindon for 2 years.
Yeah.
Like, I really encourage people to go and find this piece because it's really good. It gives you a real history of Pam Grier and a lot of the stuff she's done. I couldn't believe that fact. She lived in England. And if anyone knows Swindon, it's not a place you'd choose to live. And I think this was like the late 50s, right? So it might have been a bit different then. But that blew me. That of all the facts, Carl, that was the one that blew my mind a little bit.
Yeah, come on, Tony. You don't want to alienate listeners at this early stage of the podcast. We might have a big Swindon contingent. My missus is from Swindon, actually. So
is she?
She used to live there anyway.
Sorry to Carl's. So
he'd probably agree with you, to be fair. No, I think you're right about the miniseries. Kind of curious who they're going to get to play Quentin Tarantino, assuming it goes up to the 1990s, because that's a tough role to play. Maybe he'll play himself. Maybe he'll drop in himself.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me, to be honest.
But we are going to talk a bit more about Tarantino towards the end of this podcast.
Yeah, we are.
Because there's a topic on that I suggested. But just finally on Jackie Brown for me, perhaps before we move on, Robert Forster is fantastic in this film as the bail bondsman Max Cherry. And it's the first time I'd seen this since he died, because he died a couple of years ago, didn't he? Just a wonderful role for him. So that's what's so sweet about it, in a way. It's like, it's this very tender love story of sorts between, she's in her mid-40s, isn't she? He's a bit older. Mm. And I find that incredibly captivating.
Same. Yes, it's Pam Grier's movie, but he maybe steals it just from under it, or on par, because he's so heartbreaking. You know, he's just a lovely man who falls a bit in love with this woman. And, you know, she's blazing a trail of her own. And it is so lovely. It's such a lovely, sweet, tender dynamic they have. And they have great chemistry. And, yeah, he's just one of those actors. Because this was sort of his comeback, wasn't it? A bit like Pam Grier. You know, he then had a bounce and he was in lots of other things. And then, you know, memorably, he cropped up in Breaking Bad in quite a key role towards the end. And a little bit in Better Call Saul. And he was great in that as well. And he's one of those actors that even when he's doing rubbish, and he did do a bit of rubbish after this, I think he did... He was always good, yeah. And in this, this is maybe a career high for him, or one of them, definitely.
Completely agree. The last thing I would say is people should definitely see it if they haven't. Even if you're not a big Tarantino fan, I think this is one to give a try, really. It is very much a Tarantino piece, but then it's inflected in different ways than some of those other films, I think. Mm. So give it a go, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And it's on in cinemas, I think, throughout... September, I think it's on at various cinemas, maybe more in London, but you might find it in some of the big cities because this is playing in certain things. So especially if you can catch it on the big screen while it's on, do it. It is well worth it.
All right, so we'll move on. Tony, this is one this is not one that's made a lot of discourse generally, but it has made the news, and I sent it to you because I knew you'd be interested in it. And again, it ties back to something we've experienced in person a couple of years ago, doesn't it? So this was an article it's from the Australian press, so news.com.au. Extremely saddened and disappointed, James Bond actor George Lazenby dropped from show after creepy interview. So firstly, I think we probably will come back to James Bond quite a bit on this show because we're big Bond fans and we're going to see Spectre, aren't we, with an orchestra in a few weeks and stuff like that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
So I think from time to time it's gonna come up for sure. So yeah, George Lazenby, just for people who don't know, so the 83-year-old actor who best known really... or only known, really, I would say, by most people, for playing James Bond once. The first actor to replace Sean Connery in the James Bond films for On Her Majesty's Secret Service. So, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, a film which, at the time, didn't do too well, but over subsequent years, it's fair to say, Tony, isn't it, that it's been rehabilitated, certainly by Bond fans, who often now list it as the best or one of the best films in the series. So that seems to be the general trajectory, as it's been re-evaluated over time, yeah?
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. And it's had that Jackie Brown effect in a way, hasn't it? You know, that people... It's still a funny one because I do think it's like two or three films in one. But it's actually very faithful to the book, to Ian Fleming's book, which is very, very similar. Lazenby is better than people remember in that movie, actually. Yeah. Even though he's wooden. He is wooden, but he's got a real charisma about him. And that film is good. It's disjointed... but it's got a lot going for it, definitely.
I would tend to agree, and I think he's good in the physical stuff too. So he's got things going for him that people didn't necessarily appreciate at the time, and I think, to be fair, he had a hard act to follow. Anyway, the news article he was part of a show at the Perth Concert Hall called The Music of James Bond, and apparently then there were multiple complaints because... there's a quote here. He spent all of the interview just talking about basically his sexual conquests. He was homophobic. He swore he certainly wasn't talking about his Bond movies. He downplayed the Queen a day after she died. All right. So, and some other things too. He named women who he had slept with and there were children in the audience. So I sent this article to you and I was basically saying this is a complete non-surprise, isn't it? Because we saw Lazenby... when was it? Was it 2019, 2018, something like that?
Just before COVID, I think.
So we went down to the British Film Institute in London. They had a James Bond day on, and they were showing three films, and we could only stay for two. We saw Moonraker and On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And he did a kind of an on-stage Q&A, didn't he? And I had said to you...
David Walliams.
We were with David Walliams, that's right. I had said to you in advance, because I think I had watched one or two of his recent interviews on YouTube or something like that, or maybe I'd read something in the newspaper or something. But I had said to you beforehand, hadn't I, look, all he's going to do is... bring everything around to sex, right? What he does. That is exactly what he did, didn't he? So I don't remember it being quite as... The word they use in this article is creepy. I remember it being a little bit uncomfortable. And I think there were a few people around us at the BFI that time who were sort of like, you know, looking, like making these sideways glances at one another. But maybe not to the extent that's described there. So, yeah, Tony, I imagine, like me, you were probably not very surprised to read this, though.
No, I wasn't really, because it is... He is classic boomer in the sense that, and I mean that in the sense that he's a man of a different age. You know, he really is. I'm not excusing it, but on the other hand, you do have to factor that in. You know, if this was a guy who was 33 doing this, it would be very, very different in the sense that, like, there's absolutely no excuse. Even 43. Even maybe 53. There's no excuse. Whereas someone who's 83, who grew up... I mean, he's talked about this stuff for years. He was talking about this stuff back in the 70s, about how even in the 60s, when he, you know, that he, when he, when he became Bond, that he was just getting tons of women and, you know, he was really, by the sound of it, experiencing the, you know, the free love era and being in London and America. You know, he sowed his oats, let's put it that way. Mm. And that's the thing. Back then, even back when we were growing up, you know, I'm 40, you're a couple of years younger than me. And, you know, when we were growing up, that kind of thing was, I wouldn't say it was discouraged necessarily. You know, they're talking about, oh, sowing your wild oats, you know. It was that sort of lad culture almost in the 90s that would kind of go, wee, you know, that kind of thing. But things have changed. You know, he might have got away with this 20, 25 years ago in a different way. But now I think it just comes, especially given his age, it just comes across as very skeevy. And you know, that's the thing. He misunderstood. Maybe he's just done this too long and he should just stop, because he's misunderstanding why people are there. You know, they're not there to hear about how much he enjoyed shagging and all this. They want to know about him playing one of the most famous characters in the world. And I think maybe he's probably just bored of talking about that now, you know, after all these years.
Quite possibly. I don't remember him naming women he slept with. I remember him talking in general terms. And I remember him saying that Diana Rigg didn't sleep with him. That's what I remember. Yeah, I don't know. And I do wonder, though, does this venue have some kind of role in this? Because if they'd done a little bit of research, like I said, I knew this before we went to see him in person. So you could probably have figured out that he's going to be a bit like this. Maybe he went a bit too far. Maybe that's it. Maybe there's a line that he crossed with some of the, like it does say about homophobic comments, which I don't remember him saying anything like that.
No,
at the BFI, for example. Either. So maybe he's just gone a bit too far. But yeah, maybe if people are going to do interviews with him, or, you know, get people to pay to go and see him, maybe they just need to make it adults only. I don't know. Maybe that's the way you handle it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. But then I suppose it's the... Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah. It goes back to what you said. They should have done their research and they should have thought, is he going to be appropriate for all ages, given he's probably not going to talk about Bond just that? And he's not...
Just before we move on to your next topic then, but you had said to me when I sent this to you, you had wondered about Sean Connery. And not that he was like this in the same way. He was much more discreet in interviews, wasn't he? So very different character in that sense. But you're writing this book, or you've written this book on Connery, which is coming out at some point soon. So
Mid-October,
yeah. And I'm sure we'll talk about it again nearer the time. But you had said maybe if Connery had lived longer, he would have run into difficulties with the way society has shifted. So what were you thinking there? And like, do you think it's akin to somebody like Lazenby, or is it quite a different story?
I mean, I without spoiling the book, the cinematic Connery, the films of Sir Sean Connery, out very soon from Polaris Publishing, and the final chapter of that, I mention whether he would have survived the quote unquote cancel culture era Connery had he been, you know, like you said, he was a bit more discreet. He spent the last 10 or more years pretty much, you know, off the grid, really. He was just in the Bahamas playing golf. He didn't really get involved in much. But obviously he'd had problems for years in terms of comments he'd made over years about hitting women and what he thought about, you know, giving women a slap, going right back to the 60s. And he was being challenged on that throughout the decades. It was challenged in the 80s. It was challenged in the 90s. It didn't ever affect his reputation in the way that he was ever cancelled, you know, quote unquote. I mean, I don't really believe in cancel culture, to be honest, but I think it, as a the phenomenon of consequence culture definitely exists, and I think Connery would have struggled, you know, if he'd have been doing this kind of thing. I don't think he'd have said what Lazenby said, because I think, frankly, no disrespect to, well, maybe this is a bit of disrespect to Lazenby, but I think Connery was both a smarter and a more of an educated man. And I think he conducted himself more with a level of dignity and aplomb than Lazenby has. And I don't think he would have done this. However, I do think he would have been pushed and challenged a lot more about a lot of the views he'd held that he never really apologised for, and he never really backed down from. He just used to say, well, I didn't, it was slightly out of context, you know. He never really said, I don't agree with that. You know, he never really backed down from it. Because he was Sean Connery, and he just didn't do that. He was uncompromising. He wouldn't do that with anybody. What you saw is what you got, really. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I'm saying that I think he would have struggled a bit with... I think there would, on social media at least, I think there would have been pushback. But then, was he big enough a star, and was he charismatic enough a star to shrug it off? You know, I don't know.
It's a difficult one, because I think it is a little bit selective, sort of who comes under the microscope about some of these things. Yeah, I think because he was retired, I think there was no reason for him to sort of be in the limelight again, was there? So people weren't really thinking about a lot of these things until he died and stuff started to go around again. And then I think once people are dead, people take a slightly different attitude compared to when people are living and profiting on films and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it would have been difficult for him because things just circulate in a very different way now, don't they? It's like some of those interviews you're talking about, like there's the famous one with Barbara Walters, isn't there? And then I think there's a Playboy interview, isn't it, from the mid-60s, where he said some of these things. But if you used, I remember hearing about things like this, let's say 20 years ago, and thinking they were wrong. But what happened then is you wouldn't see them again. You know, they wouldn't constantly recirculate. You know, you might read something in a newspaper and then forget about it and not see it again for years and years. So
that's
what's changed fundamentally, as well as societal shifts. So, yeah, I think he would have, it would have been difficult for him, I think. Yeah. Maybe he could have got through it just being such a veteran and so old and so broadly well-liked, but I suspect it could have been a tricky one. But,
I mean, ultimately, he never would have done what Lazenby was doing anyway. You'd never have got him on a stage doing these things in all these places. He never wanted to do that, you know. He'd do the press interviews, but it very rarely would you have ever... He would never, in his 80s or 90s, was doing this kind of thing. So. Yeah. Maybe he just avoided, the space to do that, to put himself in this position. But Lazenby hopefully will finally rethink his stance on something.
Well, no, it sounds like definitely there are things. If we haven't got the verbatim comments of what he said, we just got kind of secondhand stuff of he was homophobic. So we don't know exactly what he said. Hopefully he'll reflect and move with the times a bit. It's possibly unlikely at this stage, to be honest.
Yeah.
But it does sound like he's, well, like you say, consequences, he's been dropped from another show and this tour. So,
okay, so we'll leave it there. That's all we've got time for in this episode of The Discourse. We're going to come back very soon to talk about a few more things in the ether. We're going to talk about the Don't Worry Darling discourse, and we're going to talk about Tarantino. And we mentioned earlier in this episode, we will be talking about him later on. We're going to be talking about him and his views on Francois Truffaut. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So stick with us. We'll be back very soon, tomorrow potentially, if you're listening on day one. So cheers, Carl. I'll see you then.
Yeah, cheers, Tony. Yeah, see you tomorrow.
Thanks everyone for listening to this first episode, and we'll see you very soon once again for more of The Discourse. Bye bye. Hey guys, my name is Tony Black, podcaster and author, and I'm here to tell you about Partisan, a podcast about politics and history in film and entertainment. I'll be joined by guests as we discuss films, TV shows, and maybe a little bit more, examining political and historical topics, such as how Elvis intersects with black cultural history.
In Lerman's film, the idea of the black characters are maybe kind of, they're used as catalysts to basically move Elvis forward in his career. I think that's how I saw it.
The rise and fall of Richard Nixon.
It seems to be, historians seem to agree with this, is that he was the first president that really capitalized on the evangelical vote and politicized them.
The disturbing class satire in society, and much, much more. Partisan is free to download on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Partisan Pod. I hope you'll vote with your feet and join us on the journey.